2 Samuel chapter number 20. 2 Samuel 20, that is in the Old Testament. If you open up a paper copy of God's Word and you start in Genesis there at the very front, you're not going to get too far. Joshua, Judges, keep going. You're going to find 1st, 2nd Samuel. If you hit Kings or Chronicles, just back up a little bit. Or Google 2 Samuel chapter number 20. As we continue on in our series, we've been going through God's grace in weakness, seeing the help and hand of God in the nation of Israel's life through precarious times of much of it their own doing or somebody's choices that have befallen others, not to their own desire. And so we've been seeing God is gracious and merciful and patient to keep working. So two chapters ago in 18, we saw that there is just consequences abounding for David and falling out on others. Then in chapter 19, we saw there's still the midst of those consequences, but God's giving grace to David, and David is reacting and responding humbly and therefore acting differently with the critics and the enemies he had as there was the split due to the coup with Absalom. And now we roll into chapter 29. It's kind of like the narrator's just kind of putting the ends to a bunch of stories or tying off a bunch of loose ends, as it were. And so I want to look at chapter number 20 here, and we're going to read the entirety of the chapter. And so look at verse 1 there, 2 Samuel chapter number 20, and note what the narrator records for us. There happened to be a man of Belial whose name was Sheba, the son of Birchi, a Benjamite. And he blew a trumpet and said, "We have no part in David. Neither will he have inheritance in the son of Jesse. Every man to his tents, O Israel." So every man of Israel went up after David and followed Sheba, the son of Birchi. But the men of Judah clave unto the king from Jordan even to Jerusalem. And David came to his house at Jerusalem. And the king took the 10 women, his concubines, whom he had left in to keep the house, and put them in ward and fed them, but went not in unto them. So they were shut up unto the day of their death, living in widowhood. Then said the king to Amasa, that's his nephew, as we'll talk about a bit later, "Assemble me the men of Judah within 3 days, and be thou here present." So Amasa went to assemble the men of Judah, but he tarried longer than the set time which he had been appointed. And David said to Abishai, "Now shall Sheba do to us more harm than did Absalom. Take thou thy Lord's servants and pursue after him, lest he get him fenced cities and escape us." And there went after him Joab's men, the Cherethites, the Pelethites, and the mighty men. And they went out of Jerusalem to pursue after Sheba, the son of Birchi. But when they were at the great stone, which is in Gibeon, Amasa went before them. And Joab's garment that he had put on was girded unto him, and upon it a girdle with a sword fastened upon his loins in the sheath thereof. As he went forth, it fell out. And Joab said to Amasa, "Art thou in health, my brother?" And Joab took Amasa by the beard with the right hand to kiss him, but Amasa took no heed to the sword that was in Joab's hand. So Joab smote Amasa in the 5th rib and shed out his bowels to the ground. And people say the Bible's boring. Get out of here, right? And struck him not again. And Amasa died. So Joab and Abishai, his brother, pursued after Sheba, the son of Bichri. And one of Joab's men stood by him, that's Amasa, and said, "He that favoreth Joab and he that is for David, let him go after Joab." Amasa wallowed in blood in the midst of the highway, and when the man saw that all the people stood still, he removed Amasa out of the highway into the field, cast a cloth upon him, when he saw that everyone that came by stood still. And when he was removed out of the highway, all the people went on after Joab to pursue after Sheba, the son of Bichri. And he went through all the tribes of Israel unto Abel. And so he goes to this city here. They gather together around him. And I want you to catch what happens here with Joab and his pursuit as they're up far north, as you can imagine, in Israel geographically. And they came and besieged him and Abel. They cast up a bank against the city. They stood it in a trench. And all the people that were with Joab battered the wall to throw it down. This is Israeli versus Israeli. It's important to know that. Then cried a wise woman out of the city, "Hear, hear, say, I pray you unto Joab, come near hither that I may speak with thee." And when Joab was come near unto her, the woman said, "Art thou Joab?" And he answered, "I am he." Then she said unto him, hear the words of thine handmaid. And he answered, I do hear. Then she spake, saying, they want to speak in old time, saying, thou shalt surely ask counsel at Abel. And so they ended the matter. I am one of them that are peaceable and faithful in Israel. Thou seekest to destroy a city and a mother in Israel? Why wilt thou swallow up the inheritance of the Lord? And Joab answered and said, far be it from me that I should swallow up or destroy. The matter is not so, but a man of Mount Ephraim, Sheba, hath lifted up his hand against the king, even against David. Deliver him only, and I will depart from the city. And the woman said unto Joab, behold, his head shall be thrown to thee over the wall. Then the woman went to all the people in her wisdom. And they cut off the head of Sheba, cast it to Joab, and he blew a trumpet, and they retired from the city, every man to his tent, and Joab returned to Jerusalem unto the king. The last few verses are some administrative positions that we'll talk about there at the end. But tonight, we're going to talk about this subject matter. Living a law-to-yourself kind of a life eventually catches up with you. I don't know if you guys watch news or read the paper, but the last maybe 2 weeks, there seems to be an uptick, at least what's being reported, maybe slow news day, as it were, an uptick of multiple stories with police pursuits in the area. Somebody taken off from the cops for whatever reason, and without fail, each of them has ended in a crash and injured either the driver of the car, hurt one of the officers, or hurt some community resident around where the crash or in the chase was taking place. And I can't help it, but each time I see one of these pursuits, somebody running from the cops in their car, the same thoughts kind of go across my mind. Don't these people know that the odds of getting away from a police chase are likely less successful than winning the lottery? I mean, when we lived in L.A., they'd put out the bird overhead with the spotlight, and you're toast, right? There's very, very slim chances you're going to get away from the cops. In fact, maybe I'd say it this way, like, car chases and cops have a pretty lopsided loss-to-win ratio there. But for whatever reason, people think they have to run due to breaking some law in the past, maybe a refusal to stop. But whatever happens in that moment before the pursuit begins, they decide to become a law unto themselves, and eventually all there is eventual calamity. Tonight, the narrator of 2 Samuel is going to give us that kind of a principle, where the principle of if you want to live a law unto yourself, you're eventually going to have it catch up with you. In doing so, the narrator is showing us the total opposite of David's behavior towards his enemies and his critics in chapter 19. David is gracious. David is humble. David is accountable. He can't erase the past, but he can make the best of what is in the present with the help of Almighty God in aligning with him. The consequences of his own doing, for sure, are taking place, but God's graciousness helping them get on track for God's purposes for them as a nation. But in chapter 20, we have a bunch of story arcs colliding and God teaching us a valuable lesson through the different story arcs. David, Joab, Amasa, Sheba's choices against God, each of those individuals and how they've decided to operate contrary to God, all of those choices kind of come to fruition and some still to come. They come to fruition and they've done great harm to those around them, but also harm to themselves. And so if there was a reality to look at from chapter 20 with the different individuals and the different scenarios taking place, because it's kind of a wild chapter, what's the lesson? Here's what it is. Being a law unto yourself places those around you and yourself in great peril. Catch it on the screen there. Eventually. Eventually. See, that's the key word, isn't it? Eventually. We often think and we often see, oh, I'll be the exception, or it's not caught up with me, or it must not have mattered, or God didn't see it, or it's not that big of a deal. But here in chapter 20, you know what we're going to see? It all matters. It all matters not because God's a tyrant, but because in his kindness and his graciousness, he's shown us and spoken to us clearly through the word about him and ourselves and others. And when we decide to flaunt it, well, you sow the wind, you reap the whirlwind. So tonight, as we think about being a law unto ourselves and how it catches up with us eventually, first lesson we want to learn is the lesson with Sheba there. Look at verses 1 and 2 and see this lesson we have with Sheba. Sheba fails to learn the lesson of all the previous examples. Somehow he thinks it won't apply to me. You remember the end of chapter 19? It starts with this bookend of people not wanting to be in alliance with an allegiance with David. There's the people who are following David and Judah, and then there's the northern tribes, and there's this conflict between the two. And so it gets a little bit settled down, but then at the end, when they all come to convey David to Jerusalem over the Jordan, remember what happens? The northern tribes are like, ho. Way too much representation from the Judah people here. We want to be represented more. And so there's these fierce words. There's a shouting match. It becomes hostile. And while David is still conveyed over, things aren't well. Well, in chapter 20, verse 1, that's where we pick up with Sheba. Note what it says there. There happened to be a man of Belial whose name was Sheba. And what does he do? He calls everybody together and says what? We don't have any part of this. The feelings of the verbal skirmish between the northern tribes and Judah, it's still fresh. And so as the embers smolder, one man picks up a fan to ignite those insurrection flames all over again. Sheba decides, I think I'll lead another rebellion after a failed one just took place. Now, let's just pause here. I think any thinking person in the room says what? Bad idea. You just watched it with Absalom, didn't you? Yes. You were even a part of it, weren't you? Yes. But this one, it's going to be different. Who is Sheba? We don't know much about him besides he's a Benjamite. So he'd have some leanings and familiarity with the household of Saul. All we do know for sure is how the narrator characterizes the character of Sheba. He's a man of Belial. Now, this term in the Old Testament is typically referring to somebody who's worthless, who's pagan in their orientation. In fact, it's used 27 times, and it's never a personal name for Satan, but it's surely indicative of how he would want something to go or to operate. The idea, again, is wickedness, worthlessness, somebody who is just prone to do mischief or evil. So Sheba may be in the covenant nation, but he is certainly not availing himself in his known character to the covenant-keeping, faithful God. So what's his plan? He makes an announcement via trumpet for all the northern tribes to reconsider their acceptance of David as king and to sever their allegiance from him. All right, if this is how it's going to be and everybody's going to be on board and David's going to come back, you know what? There's a few of us who have a dispute with that. Now, it's at this point, I think any of us, anachronistically speaking, trapped in our own time, that is, we would want to say what? Really, Sheba? Are you sure about this? Didn't you just see how that worked out? But consider how foolish this in-the-moment moment is. He's trapped there in the moment, and so he decides, I'm going to have another revolt against David. He should learn from the examples. What did David already have to do with Ishbosheth in chapter number 2? He decided to fill his oats, and what happened? He got his comeuppance, didn't he? If that weren't enough of a lesson, he also sees what? You have now Absalom's complete dismantlement. As fast as the coup arose, was as fast as it got put down. So now what do you have? Sheba has less men than Absalom did. Put that in your brain for a second, right? I'm going to lead a revolt. How's it looking out there? Worse than it did the last time. Somebody's out there, I can see, just doing a little bit of frantic math, like, you know what? I'm going to stay with David, actually. I'm going to go over there. You know, beyond that, you don't have the men Absalom had. And I would just pause and remind us, you know, as Sheba, that Joab is brutal. If his might is released against you, it's not going to be good, is it? Joab is just a war hawk. You know you don't have the cachet that Absalom had. How many years did Absalom scheme, plan, and draw and build relationships? Years. And how does his coup go? Not very well. And so somehow Sheba's like, you know what? On the heels of that, I could probably put this thing, I'll slap this thing together pretty fast. I got that. I got this. We got this. We can do this. But I'm going to say it again. Being a law unto yourself places you and those around you in great peril eventually. The foolishness, the hubris, or the pride that he has is almost unfathomable. Maybe we could say it like this before we move on. Pride can lead someone to a self-deceived state where they believe and act as if something is reality when in fact it is completely contrary to reality. They think it's the right choice for them. They're convinced of it. But almost anybody outside the circle can see what? Oh, no. That is not the direction or decision to make. I know probably some parents or grandparents in the room have been here before, right? And what is that? You've told one of your kids one thing. They decided, shockingly, not to do that one thing, didn't they? And so they get the consequences of that not doing the one thing. And you've probably said this to one of your other children. Learn the lesson, right? Let's not do this again. You would think Sheba, with Ishbosheth, with Absalom, would have learned the lesson. I kind of think of it this way when I read this. There's just these few verses. Like if this was a kid's book, the narrator might say, but it didn't go the way Sheba thought it would because he didn't learn the lesson, kids. The whole thing that he starts up is collapsed even faster than he could have ever possibly imagined. But at some level, he thought in his mind, this is going to work out. I won't submit to a covenant God. In my lifestyle, I won't submit to the anointed king, David. I'm going to lead this rebellion, and it's going to happen. It's going to work. But it doesn't. The narrator then emphasizes the same point, but in a different person's life. As we move on from Sheba not learning the example and being a law unto himself, and as we'll see come crashing down as we read earlier, he then highlights a very almost seemingly bizarre moment that seems out of place with the narrative account with David. He moves on to talk about David and what happens. The effects just keep happening with David. The ripples keep happening from the consequences of his sin over and over and over again. The king returns to Jerusalem to get resettled in the city and the palace. And who did he leave there? He faces the 10 concubines he left there. He left them there to do what? To keep eye on the house, to watch the house. But sadly, and I understand there's young people in the room, so we'll be thoughtful here. Sadly, we're aware of the inappropriate and vulgar practice Absalom performed upon these defenseless women. It was a custom amongst pagan kings to further their bloodlines, to humiliate their enemies, and satisfy their own lusts. So Absalom, driven by anger and bitterness, decides he wants to do everything he can in this coup to humiliate his father. And so he does so in a very demonstrative spectacle. Absalom has no thought for God in doing it. He has no submission to honoring his father. He has no care for the value of these women or how God has called them to be treated in the law. He acts like a total pagan. Now, it's easy for us to just pick up the stones and be like, that's right, Absalom was a worthless individual when it came to God's desires. But I would remind us and even ask us, where did he learn that behavior on how to treat women? Who had exampled how to treat women to him? Who had done things to women that were defenseless? Who? David. These poor women are suffering the consequences from Absalom due to the example of his father, who also violated God's law, who also behaved in a pagan manner by even having the concubines. He devalued these women. He acted like a pagan counterpart king would have acted towards women. And now these poor women have gone from one king acting in a non-covenant way towards them to another person acting worse, if you could say it that way, towards them, against God's commands, against God's desires. And now David's having to do what? Well, David comes back, and he tells them, basically, I'm going to put you in a nice place. You'll have the necessities cared for. You're going to be taken care of. That sounds like a long way. Okay, protection, provision. That's good. But also, what do? They live out the rest of their lives shut up in widowhood. It's like they're living widows. Do they have protection? Sure. Do they have provision? Yeah. But do they have a purpose or a future hope of anything in this life? Not by my idea, and probably not yours either. One author said it like this: David's earlier decision to indulge in forbidden sexual activity was now responsible for his inability to enjoy legitimate pleasures on a larger scale with one wife. Furthermore, by damaging one woman's life, Bathsheba, David now ended up damaging the lives of 10 concubines. I'm going to say it again. When you want to live by your own law, it puts you and those around you in peril eventually. So he's saying Sheba doesn't learn from the example. David is facing consequences from earlier actions, and these women have reaped repercussions for more than what they ever should have because of David. But if that's not enough, the narrator goes, layer of cake, let's add another layer to this cake, and here he gives us the issue of Amasa and Joab. Unfortunately for Amasa, Joab decides the king's plan for unity is invalid, and therefore he decides, I can eliminate a rival. There'll be no problems. We saw it in verse number 4. What does he do? He dispatches Amasa, his newly minted military leader, to go assemble the men of Judah to chase down Sheba because another civil war is brewing. Now remind us, who is Amasa? That's his nephew. Who is Amasa? It's Joab and Abishai's cousin. So it's all in the family, isn't it? These are not total strangers to one another. They all have familiarity. They all have family ties. And so this swift action has to be taken in David's mind. So he has Amasa get 3 days to get the forces together and get back. But according to the narrator, Amasa fails the task. He goes to assemble the men of Judah, but he doesn't do it in the timeline commanded and prescribed by the king. So the king moves from Amasa to his cousin, Amasa's cousin, David's nephew here, Abishai. It's Joab's brother, and he is there watching the whole scenario develop. What is David's evaluation of it that we read? That this rebellion is going to create more turmoil than Absalom's did. Now, somebody may say, well, Absalom's had years and really built up strong, and how could David have such a skewed scale here? David seems to be just recognizing that time gives opportunity for solidification. Solidification gives more opportunity to come back against and create another civil war. What's interesting to note here, David's speaking to Abishai and not Joab. We have to remember, what's happened to Joab? Because he killed Absalom, it seems like this is punishment to Joab. He's been demoted. Amasa was promoted to the head of the Israeli forces there militarily. And so Joab is out of the picture or out of the loop, seemingly, in these military decisions. For whatever reason, Abishai is dispatched to collect the mighty men and then the Philistine specialist mercenary groups to pursue Sheba before he escapes out of the northern kingdom and can amass a group to come back. So there's this small group of Judeans and this small grizzled group of veteran soldiers and mercenaries, and they go to pursue Sheba. In verse number 8, we read, Amasa does what? He joins back up with the group. Now, this is important for later as we think about it. Abishai's been dispatched in his place. We read that obviously Joab is in this procession as well. And Amasa, who's failed to get the king's men gathered together to pursue Sheba, he shows up on the scene, and where does he go? Right to the front of the line as the proud leader of the military force. He's out there, and he's in front. And that's where the scene gets really graphic, doesn't it? Look back at verse 8. You have there them gathering together, and note who appears in the account. Joab. It starts describing how Joab is dressed and what he has on him. Joab has intentionally dressed and is behaving in a manner so that his intentions for Amasa are going to be shaded, or they're going to be veiled, if we could, before he springs into action. I want you to read there and see what he says in verse 9. Joab said to Amasa, "Art thou in health, my brother?" But before he does that, what happens? In verse 8, he has this girdle, he has this sword. It seems like he drops it and he puts it in a left hand, and it just seems kind of weird to us. So let's break it down and understand what's going on here. Joab is no dummy. He seems to be a military tactician. So when he's going to approach the person who's been promoted over him, who he hates, Joab is a very vengeful man, he's not doing anything accidentally. The narrator describes it like Joab's like, "Oh, hey, Amasa," and oops, like he fumbles the sword out of the sheath. This is a grizzled veteran, right? And he butterfingers his sword. It's this little daggery knife. It's not even his full fighting sword. and he butterfingers it, that's the point of the narrator. Joab is being very sly. He has this dagger on his belt. He pretends he fumbles it out when he goes to greet Amasa. He then intentionally picks it up with his left hand, not the hand of fighting, not the hand of swinging a sword. That was typically right hand by culture. And also your greeting and hospitality is by right hand. And so him, oops, fumbling, grabbing, hey, Amasa, extending a right hand. What does Amasa naively think? Hey, what's up, cousin? Is that Joab's intentions? Oh, no. Joab hasn't butterfingered anything. In his tactical deceit, he goes to reach in for a cultural kiss, probably the kiss on each side of the face as was culturally normal there. And as soon as he gets close enough, he grabs the beard, and what does he do? Right into his gut. It was no butterfinger. It was no oops. He stabs the man who's the leader of the army right in the stomach in front of who? God and everyone. That's who. And he lets him hit the ground, and it says there that he wallows in his own blood. The word for wallow here is not pretty. It's the idea of rolling and shaking and spasming. Amasa is there bleeding to death in front of the entire army, their great leader, supposedly. And Joab has taken his life. In verse number 11, an unknown follower of Joab stands next to Amasa's body that's reeling and writhing. You know what he says? If you follow King David, then you'll follow Joab as we go to get Sheba. Basically saying, you're either with us or you're not. Now, this could be my own speculation and you could disagree. That'd be okay. I don't think it's unfair to say an implicit message is, you can follow us, or you can be with Joab, who's doing David's work, which is not true. It's a treacherous statement, because what's happened to Joab? He's been demoted by the king. But Joab takes the law into his own hands, like he usually did, and he stabs this man and leaves him there. And so now you have some unknown guy saying, you know, go after Joab. It becomes such a looky-loo situation that they end up taking the body, dragging it to the off the road, throwing a cloth over him so that the crowd will keep moving. What am I trying to drive into our thoughts here? This is an unceremonious way to die as the king's nephew and military commander. Can you imagine if something like that happened here in America with a top official? That would not fly, would it? We would look at ourselves as a banana republic if one of our top military officials did this to another military official. We'd be losing our minds. Like, what is going on here? That's what's taking place with Amasa, with Joab. But neither of it happens by accident. I'm saying it again. Being a law unto yourself places you and yourself as yourself and others in great peril eventually. We feel maybe a little bad for Amasa, but that would be misplaced. Why? Who sided with the coup with Absalom? Amasa did. Who took up arms against the Lord's anointed? Amasa had. Along the way, we get this idea from the narrative accounts that Amasa is put into positions he just doesn't have the acumen to keep. Absalom's general, easily defeated by Joab, apparently. David's leader, unable to even assemble the men in time for his king. Joab's enemy, unable to deduce that revenge was on the horizon. As the kids say, play stupid games, do what? Win stupid prizes, right? Joab does not see the need to honor the king's plans or orders. Amasa is too naive or prideful to see what's even coming his way. He's made decisions with no thought for God, and it has caught up to him. Do you think if you could go back and interview Amasa when the coup's going well? Remember, they're driving on Jerusalem. David's on the run out of Jerusalem. What do you think the interview would go like? Hey, Amasa, how's it going? So, well, you know, we had some great strategy, some great soldiers here. It's going well. He's the old generation. He's on the run. You know, he's done his part. And now it's time for Absalom to take place. David's been running us into the ground. So the future is bright. I wonder how that same interview goes by the side of the road. Did he see it coming? No, because I'm living under my law, unto myself. It's all going to be fine. If that weren't enough in this passage, check out Joab. Joab forces a city to take the place of the king and appointed judicial leaders and how they handle another Israeli with Sheba. We read the passage there. I won't recap it too much except to say Joab chases Sheba about as far north as you can. You can see it on the map here. They're way up. You can see on the far right side there, or not far right, but mid right, you have the Lake of Galilee, and they are going as far up as possible. He is trying to get on the run, assemble everybody so they can come back again. The northern tribes don't get cemented around him the way Sheba thought it would happen. And so he runs to this city named Abel, and he's there to try to find some refuge. It's here that he takes refuge and kind of makes his stand against Joab and the armed forces of David. Joab, as we read, utilizes a strategic move to seize the city. They're compiling dirt on dirt to build a ramp to force a besiegement against the walls, so to either scale or to crush the walls or crush the gates. And they want to do this just to get at Sheba. Well, while they're battering it, as we read, and they're battering and battering and battering, at verse number 16, with the clattering of their defenses falling, we're introduced to somebody by the narrator who's called a wise woman. And she does what? She yells over the wall, "I need to talk to Joab. I know he's in charge of the armed forces. I need to speak with him, and I want to know what's going on and how we can appease this." Now, this is somewhat remarkable given the status of women and their time. They wouldn't usually be the one to speak up or have a position to say anything to somebody as, quote, prestigious as Joab. I think it's also incredible that she decides to take on speaking to Joab, knowing that he was kind of like Boaz at one point. Ruthless. Oh, it's so bad. We're moving on. The wise woman gives a reasonable argument for Joab to consider. She gives three reasons she wants Joab to think about. The first we read, she kind of gives a history or a narrative about their city. The wise woman began by providing Joab with this historical understanding that the city you're besieging has always been a place of reconciliation or a place of unity, a place where things can get settled. That's what we're known for. Can we use this word? They were known for being peacemakers. They were a place where things could get bartered and resolved. So she says, "Hey, you can come here. We're willing to work. That's what we do. It's kind of what we're known for." But then she goes on from the history of the city, and she talks about her character. She said, "Are you here to destroy and swallow up a mother in Israel?" What's she saying by that? She's attempting to show fidelity to the Lord and call Joab back to how he's supposed to provide protection for women in Israel. And then she adds a third point to her case, the relationship that they share together, Joab, her, and all the people that are in the city and out of the city. What are we? We're covenant people. You're going to destroy the Lord's inheritance? What's she doing? She wants Joab to go all the way back to the Abrahamic covenant and remember that God has given them a land together. They are God's people together. And so there may be rifts and there may be problems, but do you really want to do this, Joab? Do you really want to come upon this city of fellow Israelis and murder all of us because of your desire for one individual? So verse number 20 is comical to me. Joab kind of rebuffs it in an exaggerated fashion. He's like, "Far be it for me, far be it for me. Oh, that's not what I'm going to do. That's not something I would ever do. That was never my intent." I would just pause and give a little commentary here to say, I think we should be leery of accepting verse 20 at face value, given Joab's pragmatic and lawless ways throughout his tenure in the Bible. He says, "Far be it from me, I'm not going to do any of that," as they bang the battering ram on the wall. "I just need Sheba. If all you'll do is give me Sheba, all will be fine." So if they'll deliver Sheba, Joab says, "I'm just going to go on my way." It's like he's trying to have them into this corner here of, "Hey, your fate's in your own hands. I mean, you can give me Sheba, or I'll take the whole city down brick by brick if I have to." This is what makes his rebuff of her accusation seem disingenuous. "If you don't give me what I'm asking for, Sheba the traitor, then I'll just have no choice. You're traitors too, of course, and I'm just going to have to go through with this." Now, before we say that's a little too much reading between the lines, consider there's no negotiations. There isn't a plan B. There isn't any other idea or alternative plans. It's besiegement or ultimatum. Give me him or I'm coming in. It's that or the other. There is no in between. Now, verse 22, we don't know the content of what the wise woman's speech is, but it says she takes the message of Joab, Sheba, all right, I'll be right back. She goes behind the wall. Whatever she said, they took some swift action. And what do? They remove Sheba's head from his body, and they give it to Joab as sign of no life. She convinces her fellow city people to do something that's almost unimaginable for us in our day and time and culture. And before we condemn her behavior, I would argue that the reputation of Joab has preceded him. She knows he's going to stop at nothing to accomplish his goal. And they're in this spot of ultimatum. We can hand the guy over, but let's do this. Let's make sure he knows we've handed the guy over. If we kill him, then we know everything will be done. One author said it this way, Sheba's severed head provided Joab with convincing proof that his military objective had been met and the war was over. So Joab does what? He blows the trumpet. They leave, and everybody at Abel can do what? Take a big exhale. No more besiegement. In this full circle moment, Sheba's law unto himself, it did what? It caught up to him fully, and it caught up to him finally. Perhaps worse, though, is this. It's that Joab's outlook and actions created a desperate scenario in which one of the issues that the woman feared would happen actually happened to someone. She was the perpetrator of it. What do you mean, Pastor? What was one of her concerns that she gave to Joab? Are you going to break through here and kill fellow Israelis? Oh, far be it from me, mother. Far be it from me. Then what did she do? Did the very thing. Now, again, we could be rough on her, but I think she recognized something, unfortunately. I have this war hawk at the door, and he's knocking in an unhelpful way. We have about one option left here. I would submit to us that Joab pushed people in the nation of Israel to act in an ungodly and law-breaking way. What was this man supposed to face according to the law? At least the king and some other judicial process in Israel. And because of Joab and his ruthlessness, he has them bypass all of the proceedings outlined in the law and participated in, implicitly, and in killing or executing a fellow Israeli. And while one might say, well, problem solved, it was not supposed to be solved that way. Drives this odd character throughout David's reign in that he just sows and sows and sows and doesn't seem to reap nearly what he sows. But spoiler alert, that comes eventually sooner than later. The passage ends with various regime assignments with people David loved like Zadok and Abiathar, people he distrusted like Joab. Nation has someone set over them who can enlist them in servitude for the king's desire and the nation's projects, just like Samuel warned them would happen. But what we keep seeing is David, Joab, Amasa, Sheba, they all make these choices against God, and it brings harm to them and others eventually. Now, it's easy to sit here, and as we think about winding this message down, we say, well, bunch of dummies. Wow, that's a really bad series of decisions for all these folks to make. It's easy to sit here tonight and see them as culpable and liable for things we think we would never do or never imagine doing. But consider the truths embodied in David, Sheba, Joab, Amasa, and frankly, Israel at large during this time. Let's give us a few closing thoughts. If we let culture or convenience form our thoughts and then help us and aid us in our choices, my friends, we're a law unto ourselves. When we decide not to make decisions based on what the Word of God explicitly says, we've just become a law unto ourselves. Well, I'm no Sheba. That guy was so foolish. Well, I'm never going to end up like Amasa. Well, Joab is so tactical. He's never going to meet his fate. It's easy to see the foolishness in others, but let's ask ourselves when we're alone to ourselves as well. When we have a decision to make, it's not explicitly maybe stated in the scripture, and we decide, I'm not going to seek counsel from godly folks, our church and beyond, the family of God, if you would. We're law unto ourselves. When a brother or a sister speaks to us about a concern we have, or they have about us, and we push back, we just reject it, friends, don't mistake it. What are we becoming? A law unto ourselves. When we fail to accept accountability for our actions or for those around us, we're what? A law unto ourselves. Like Joab did so often, when we leverage others to get our own way, what are we? A law to ourselves. Over and over, these traits I just described are seen in David and Joab, shortly in Amasa, and shortly in Sheba, and Saul in Absalom, because it's a human situation, not just a them situation. And I'm as prone to that as you are prone to that. And that's why we have to come back to asking ourselves, am I being a law unto myself in my walk with the Lord, in my marriage, in my parenting, in my job, in my outlook on time, in my usage of wealth, in my, and we have to ask some hard questions. Nothing helpful, edifying, or eternally productive takes place in such moments, but there's always hope. Why? Because repentance, reconciliation, and accountability can bring us back to where God wants us. There still may be some consequences, but we don't have to proceed to the eventually in hard-heartedness. None of us submit to God and get it right all the time. I know that, you know that. But he knows that we know the propensity we have. And so in his kindness, he intervenes over and over because he doesn't want the persistence to be a law unto ourselves to do what it does in damage. Tonight, friends, we think about this passage. We think about the characters contained within the narrative. And it's helpful for us to always pause and ask God, am I submitting to what you said, or am I giving some margin to try to be a law unto myself? And if I am, where do I actually think it's going to take me? Because the reality is it always takes us to a place that we never anticipated. The Bible is filled with account after account, person after person, men and women and couples and nations and churches ending up in places they just never anticipated. It's not because there weren't off-ramps along the way. When we persist in hard-heartedness about it, it only affects us and others immediately, but surely, eventually. So here's what I want to encourage about. Let's take a moment tonight as we think about these characters and how their accounts went and see that they just decided, I'll be a law to myself and what's going to be the harm, or I'll always be okay, and recount our own life and ask God, show me some areas where I'm deciding I'll do what I please, how I want, when I want, and I'm not going to submit and I'm not going to seek counsel. I'm just going to be and do as I please. So let's have a moment. Our heads are bowed. We'll have some music play. And as it plays, I just want to ask us to consider what the Lord's doing in our life, any area that we need to come back in confession with, an area we need help with, an area that we want to help somebody else with in humility, but an area maybe where we've decided we're going to be a law unto ourselves. Whether it's our personal life, our marriage, our thought process about our kids, finances, time. Oh, there's so many ways that we're prone to be a law unto ourselves that God needs to step in and deliver us from what we would eventually take. So let's take a moment tonight.